Space is Davon Love, Director of Public Policy, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. And of course, my colleague, my brother, Lawrence Grand Prix, Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lawrence, today, as we've talked about these segments that you and I do, you know, there are a lot of conversations that you and I have, we have amongst our team, that I think is good for us to have, you know, in a public space. And so, you know, Black nationalism, mm-hmm. you know, is something we've wrestled with for years, and it's been really a foundational part of our political socialization. And for the purpose of this conversation, for those watching, you know, we're going to use Black nationalism and Pan-Africanism interchangeably, you know, even though one can define them as meaning different things. You know, when I think about the kind of simplest way to explain what we mean when we say Black nationalism, we're talking about Black people having control of the institutions that govern our lives, right? So at a very basic level, that's what we're describing. So we may use those terms interchangeably. And to me, that notion has always been pretty common sense. But it took some years into, you know, my study and thinking about Black liberation to really come into focus with the notion that this idea of Black people exercising political agency was something that often was least pronounced in a lot of the political discussions, around Black liberation. And one of the places that for me this became most evident is how particularly 19th and early 20th century Black political history, particularly 19th century political history for Black folks, Black people often rendered, you know, we're talking about the 1800s, so, you know, the first half of that century, you know, chattel slavery. Black people primarily as objects of oppression. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes people don't see the political activity of Black folks during that period of time, right? They think of us primarily as folks subject to enslavement. And to the extent that there is, you know, conversation around our liberation, there's conversations about the abolition of slavery and the abolitionist movement and some of the figures that are most known to the general public, you know, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman. And even those folks, though in some ways curated to, I think, protect a certain historiography, even aspects of their legacy, right? There are places where you think about Frederick Douglass, one of his contemporaries, Martin Delaney, right, who was an avowed, you know, Black nationalist, Pan-Africanist, and saw himself, you know, as and Frederick Douglass saw them each other as contemporaries of each other. But of course, the historiography that would put Martin Delaney at the margins, put Frederick Douglass at the center, because of Frederick Douglass' belief in America as a, you know, as a multiracial democratic experiment. And so, you know, just say a little bit about how you observe or how important that dynamic is as it relates to thinking about or lifting Black people out of being primarily just objects of oppression.
Yeah, I think you have to understand, like, I wasn't raised in a political household, so I've had to understand these things on a journey. I think in the initial part of the journey where I was is where I think many people are, which is, how could any of that stuff before basically the civil rights movement have been useful if what it led to was so bad for us that we needed to have this massive civil rights movement? I think what I've come to realize, you could easily flip that argument, which is, how can we defend integration as the assumption that this is the ultimate model of success, given how bad things are for us now? Mm-hmm. So when that model flips in your mind, you actually take seriously these arguments about the stagnation of Black progress, the eroding of the Black middle class, the rise of the prison industrial complex, the elimination of things like minority set-asides and versions of affirmative action that can actually impact the Black middle class, and actually affirmative action becoming essentially a Black elite phenomenon. It's like, well, integration has actually been politically not so great. What else did we do? What other models are there? What else is there? And it's very hard to take seriously that is anything in the 19th century worth studying, because all we can think of is how bad we were. Lynching, white people being mean to us. And when you eliminate the stories of Black success stories, when you eliminate even understanding that the infrastructure for things like the civil rights movement were born in some of these independent Black political struggles, then you begin to understand the importance of studying, the people who were in the Reconstruction saying, we'll take the money from Reconstruction but leave the white teachers aside. you know, but we don't study those schools. I mean, we've had elders say things like, you know, understanding the importance of independent black schools that doesn't just start in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. This goes all the way back to, you know, 1840s, really, you know, in terms of free blacks teaching black children. And I was reading a book the other day about Baltimore and Amazon, and basically was like, well, the first kindergarten was in Sparrow's Point facility for the workers at Sparrow's Point. And it's like, it may have been the first German-style kindergarten, but it wasn't the first facility teaching young black children.
Right.
And that erasure of the actual clear empirical reality of black people teaching each other gets erased because the first kindergarten that had a European model that white people recognized was tied to this labor movement, was tied to Sparrow's Point. And it just assumed, oh, we must have to go with the labor movement because that's the only way we get kindergartens. It's like, no. But that's the subtle and tacit political training we get when we allow Eurocentric historiography to narrate to us our history.
And so, and even delving into some of those examples, you know, the Haitian Revolution, for example, when we think about, because oftentimes when we talk about the historical saga of the Civil War and the abolition of chattel slavery in its most formal sense, it gets reduced to contestation between the North and the South. And what often happens is people don't recognize that the Haitian Revolution and what they were able to do to, in many respects, you know, defeat one of the most powerful colonial powers in the world. You know, it's a part of why the United States has such vast land. You know, the Louisiana Purchase came as a result of the French needing to get it off their hands because of how badly they were defeated by the Haitians in the Haitian Revolution, which set in motion inspiration of people of African descent around the world, and particularly the United States, to engage in rebelling, you know, against, you know, the plantation owners and, you know, just the white monopoly capital. And one of the things that I think gets lost in that is that it created a context where it stopped being in the interest of white folks to maintain chattel slavery in the form that it was in. And flipping that narrative, then it requires us to then think about black people as producing our own freedom, as opposed to relying on benevolent white folks. And when I think about, you know, even some of the historical antecedents to contemporary black nationalism, which we'll get to, you know, in a little bit, I think sometimes people stop at best they might stop at a Martin Delaney, right? But one of the things that I don't think happens enough is I don't think folks go far enough and they don't go deep enough. And when I say far enough, you know, I'm talking about like the Maroon Wars in the Caribbean, particularly in Jamaica, right? The independent African settlements, the Maroon societies, kind of away from the plantation system, you know, in Bahia and Palmares in South America. Like, to me, those serve as antecedents to black nationalism as, you know, African, culturally African societies that remain independent and control the institutions that govern the workings of their community and how they were situated. It doesn't go deep enough because, to the point you mentioned about even some of the civic life here in Baltimore, you know, we have, you know, documentation of the African Academy as early as the year 1800. Daniel Coker, a minister that comes from New York, comes down to Baltimore to establish the African Academy, you know, which essentially was in the basement of what became Bethel AME, you know, one of the most popular churches in Baltimore. So, you know, so to your point, and a part of why for me this particular point is so important is because in many ways, the way that one tells history, that if history is told from the perspective that what we needed to do was petition white people in Congress to get our freedom, as opposed to the wide range of things that black folks did to empower ourselves, then it frames the kinds of political calculus you know, that people engage in, you know, contemporaneously. I want to come back to your point around integration, because I think this is the other piece where this history becomes important. Because, again, if our strives for freedom are reliant on petitioning white people for our freedom, the notion of integration then becomes a kind of, it makes sense. It's a logical extension of what it is that Black folks should do. Say something about the way that the historiography of petitioning white people for our freedom, and therefore integration being the natural extension, some of the ways that you would say that usurps efforts around Black independent formations as the basis for our political struggle.
Yeah, I think part of it is the assumption that the only institution that can meet our needs at scale is the American government and these white institutions that have access to white money. And you actually don't understand that, well, for a long time, Black people did not really have access to these institutions. So did they just magically survive? Were they all just totally down bad? I think part of the problem is, yeah, people think that, yeah, they were just totally down bad because they don't hear any stories of people, how they met their needs. Like, what were the actual systems that kept people alive? It's like they assume it's just prayer in the Black church and even little stuff. Like, I remember a long time ago in college, I was actually doing this report on gardening. And the legacy of slaves post-emancipation having gardening technologies that were extremely productive in feeding themselves. And actually, white folks came down to the South and taught them more Eurocentric models of gardening that were more aesthetically linear, like rows and columns, and fit a Eurocentric notion of division, were actually less productive in terms of producing food for people. Mm. So you basically had white civilizing agents come down. It's like, this garden looks like an African jungle. Mm. This looks uncivilized. Mm. We need to civilize this garden. And actually, they were actually less productive in terms of what they actually brought. But people don't understand. It's like, you know, these slaves, they weren't like just slaves. They were escaping and going fishing. They had a patch behind the slave shed where they had their own produce they were growing. Like, it wasn't just begging master for a roll, an extra portion of gruel. They had their own systems. And again, it's like, even I, it's like, what were the methodologies of agriculture in the Maroon societies? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then because this is erased from our understanding, and at best, Maroons are sentimentalized as almost like noble savages.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we don't actually study like empirically, strategically, in terms of detail, like what were the actual institutions in these societies? Like, how did they do governance? Like, how did they do these things? There's no real desire to focus on that because the assumption is there's no there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing there really useful to study. So it was all precursor to the birth of the NAACP. It was all a precursor to Du Bois. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that we have a linear trajectory of history that leads to Du Bois, NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, Brown v. Board, and that is the trajectory, everything flows into that, you fail to understand the actual necessity of understanding the reality of how people survived really had almost nothing to do with those empirical, Eurocentric, traditional historiographic points of the timeline. That the actual society of living had everything to do with reciprocal structures of governance, accountability, and meeting people's needs that just aren't focused on in that timeline. Mm.
So, you know, one of the things I imagine some people are thinking, and one of the ways in which I think Black nationalism gets typecast is that it, you know, thinking about other forms of oppression. Before we drill down into some of that, though, you know, thinking about other political formations that Black people have been a part of. You mentioned the NAACP. You know, of course, there were Black folks who are part of the labor movement and a complicated history there, both the Communist Party and the Socialist Party. You know, Black folks have complicated relationships to those formations that in important ways, you know, have done things to that have benefited Black people. One of the things that you and I have constantly have returned to in studying those movements is that there were always anxieties within those formations about Black people practicing autonomy. And so, you know, wanting to be clear to those listening that, you know, we're not saying that, you know, challenge like that the Communist Party or Socialist Party labor movement did nothing good. And that the things that they raise, particularly in terms of capitalism and class, aren't important things for Black people to theorize. But in studying the political history and what I would describe as the overwhelming tendency of those formations. Because, of course, they're, you know, you got African Blood Brotherhood and, you know, Harry Hayward, and you got, you know, Claudia Jones. So you have, you know, black folks that are in those, you know, labor, communist, and socialist formations. You have a lot of black people that start in those formations and leave. You know, Hubert Henry Harrison, you know, George Padmore. And so, you know, so we have black folks in those formations, but I would argue that their overwhelming tendency of those formations is anxieties around notions of black autonomy in ways that I think is particularly important. It makes black nationalism, I think, an essential part, an essential underlying frame for interpreting some of these politics. And so to me, this is where the notion of integration in some ways cuts across ideology. Right, because even though, for instance, you know, Communist Party is calling for an overhaul of the capitalist system, you know, of the United States, you know, what does that mean in terms of black people's control over our own, you know, institutions that govern our lives? And that in many ways, black folks occupy subordinate positions in those, you know, so-called, in many respects, multiracial coalitions. You know, and so I think, you know, one of the things I think is hard for people is I think sometimes integration gets reduced to the sentimental aspect of black people and white people being able to coexist. But I think that obscures the power differential even within coalitions that seemingly are desiring to advance the, you know, concerns facing black people. Do you find that that tendency to address those anxieties are difficult in conversations, particularly when we talk about the broader left that see themselves as trying to accomplish the same goal? And again, still, I think, marginalizing black nationalism, do you observe some of those same anxieties?
Yeah. I mean, I think that for black folks, a lot of the folks who end up, I mean, I think, some of the folks that end up working with the socialists, it's like they couldn't get a check anywhere else, right? So we have this reality where in order for us to survive, and sometimes in order for us to feel like we are in the larger flow of political history, we have to engage these white institutions because the attacks on our independent black institution leaves us with no place else to go, right? So that gets then narrated as then proof that the black radical people all did interracial coalitions. They all gave with the socialists. They all were part of the labor movement. And as opposed to seeing that as one part of a larger strategy, you just cut off the trajectory that oftentimes leads those people away from the socialists later in life. I think there's a common reality where black folks are frozen in time at a particular period when they were doing stuff with white folks. Mm-hmm. And that's like, especially when they're young. Mm-hmm. So it's like, Du Bois is stuck at Souls of Black Folks for other people.
Right.
And, you know, there's a very common refrain where, again, with Malcolm, it's almost the reverse. Like, some of the stuff he says at the end gets taken out of context to invalidate everything he did at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But that's just a reality where white folks sentimentalize these very specific examples of incidences of interracial cooperation. They say that's the template that every black person must be held to as the precondition for this is how you must engage us. As opposed to, like, actually, well, what actually came of that cooperation? Like, what is the empirical result of it? Why did this person eventually go away from this movement if you said it was so great, right? Like, again, like Lenin says, he's going to support people, national people seeking autonomy. And so people like Henry Haywood tried to narrate black condition in America as an oppressed colony. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, like, we're just like those colonies you said you would support, Lenin. Can help us, as opposed to like people and saying, well, Lenin, he has a lot of internal minorities he didn't actually want to give autonomy to himself. Right, so the history of the Soviet Union is very complex in terms of actually supporting oppressed minorities. Similarly, the history of the communist movement in terms of sticking with the black belt thesis, like, of course they don't.
Right.
So the reality empirically of this interracial cooperation gets glossed over because of the sentimentality of, why don't you like talking to me? Mm-hmm. Why don't you like having you're joining the larger movement, why are you fracturing the left? And there's this sort of affective assumption that the only way for black people to legitimately engage is if they're conciliatory with the white left and willing to join their coalitions and engage them and not critique them and really just not do their own thing. It's a very act of doing your own thing is somehow a critique of what the white folks are doing. Like maybe I just don't care.
Yeah. Let's drill down to this point with Garvey, and this kind of takes us into the next part of the conversation. If we drill down with Garvey. Because Garvey, I think, is a good example of a variety of things you just mentioned. Garvey, and of course, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, you know, founded by Garvey and his, you know, first wife, Amy Ashwood Garvey. And, you know, comes to the United States, builds, you know, to this day, one of the largest mass movements of people of African descent, you know, in history, the West. And Garvey, you know, does a variety of things. Some people, I think, pigeonhole him to, like, the Back to Africa piece, which I think does a disservice to all the other things he did, which includes, and I highlight this in workshops that I do, includes, like, legislative advocacy around anti-lynching, right, and the involvement and the momentary collaboration between the UNIA and the NAACP on that front. But when we think about Garvey and the way that he's characterized, and of course, you know, there are legitimate criticisms of almost all of these figures, but there seems to be a characterization, I think, of him being more conservative politically than I think he actually is in terms of the nature of his movement. I think because he focused so much on enterprise, right, and building like independent black enterprise as a way to help fund and fuel the UNIA. And I think if we look at that period of time, you know, in many respects, it made Garvey one of the most powerful figures, you know, in the United States. Certainly, you know, I think I'm sure a lot of our listeners would be aware that J. Edgar Hoover, one of J. Edgar Hoover's first assignments was to follow and try to neutralize Garvey and the UNIA. But I think Garvey gets described, you know, as more conservative than he is. We see during that period of time, folks like Du Bois that was still in some ways early in his political trajectory. Folks like A. Philip Randolph, you know, Chandler Owen. You know, you have like black folks, and it goes to the point that you made about in order for a lot of us to survive, it's a place where we get a check. It's a place where there's resources to be able to live. And so, you know, so you have folks for whom their ability to live comes from the white networks that they're associated with. Garvey being kind of the lone person or the lone institution, rather, the UNIA, that is not at all dependent. And we see, and so, but again, I think that the utility of having a movement that is self-sufficient, I think Garvey gets obscured and then that lesson gets lost. And what gets projected onto Garvey, I remember reading his book. Amy Jacques Garvey's collection, The Opinions and Beliefs of Marcus Garvey, but it's an actual series of texts that he wrote. And he says something about the communists that I think is something that I don't know that leftists take seriously. He says a part of the reason why he rejects communism was because the people who were communists during that period of time were racist towards black folks. And that trying to get black people to integrate into a racist institution would be further subjugating black people. Right. To me, that's something that I feel like gets dismissed as like not being ideologically mature, as opposed to what I think is I would imagine from his perspective, a good call in terms of time and space, right? Like these, in many respects, are European immigrants from Eastern Europe that don't respect black people, right? And that his rejection of communism had less to do with a desire to be connected to capitalism as a system, but more to do with making kind of a political calculus. But yeah, you know, what do you think about? Because I think Garvey's a good example of just all the things, the caricatures that people make of black nationalism that then obscure our ability to see some of the effective things that he did that those on the left, the broader left, should incorporate in order to be effective.
Yeah, I think that for me it's important to understand how Garvey is caricatured and dismissed. Like, few people, like if you were around many academic spaces, you wouldn't know Garvey wrote anything. You would think he was just a charismatic speaker, right? And they boil down his speeches to the things they can use to discredit him. Like, you know, when he might talk about the nationalist movements are focused on German greatness. You know, it's like he was a Hitler lover. And it was like, no, he was just saying that's an example of a people trying to rise up and affirm themselves. So this whole thing of, like, again, trying to link nationalism of black people with Zionism and nationalism of Europeans. And then it's this projection of, like, the worst of European nationalism gets automatically tied to all black nationalism, especially Garvey. And the reality of all the things that people were doing on the ground in UNIA branches is just ignored. Like, all the mutual aid, all the support, all the aggregation of resources. And it all gets boiled down to Black Star Line. And he never actually set foot in Africa. So the big conceptual quixotic things are used to say, oh, he failed. So the movement was not that good. As opposed to the actual rank-and-file UNIA members value the work they did together. Sometimes because of Garvey, sometimes irrelevant of Garvey, sometimes despite Garvey. Right? So the actual lived experience of UNIA members within the larger leftist academic narration just gets left off, and all you get is these caricatures, which also obscure, like, the violence done to the Garvey movement by folks like J. Edgar Hoover, but also folks like the socialists, who were combined with W.E.B. Du Bois to undermine Garvey and just undermine the movement. So those failures are seen as innate, like the Black Star Line wasn't sabotage. You know, of course, you know, he probably should have had somebody actually knew something about ships by the ships. It was still sabotage, right? So just even understanding, like, it is a part of a larger trajectory of movement that people on the ground, working class, lower class black people found valuable. As an organizing technique, that reality is often ignored by leftists in terms of the personality of Garvey and how them and their circles relate to that personality. And I think that just as an organizing technique and as a knowledge production understanding technique, getting too caught in those caricatures or those individual examples, you just miss the forest through the trees. You know, it's I don't think it's a good intellectual technique to understand what Garveyism was beyond the actual person of Garvey.
Yeah, and you know, as I have, you know, again, over the years, developed my own kind of political perspective, and as I kind of mentioned in the very beginning, you know, black nationalism to me was just common sense. And as I began to read more and started to encounter some of the criticisms of black nationalism, I remember having thoughts that were like, you know, these things don't seem inherent. These criticisms don't seem inherent to black nationalism, but more so criticisms of certain iterations. And I break down the criticisms of black nationalism into five different categories. There's the black feminist critique of black nationalism. There's the critique of black nationalism as, you know, so-called reverse racism or wanting to exert violence against white people. There's the criticism of, you know, that it's black capitalism. And there's the criticism that it centers on just wanting to engage in violence. And then the last one is that it's less rigorous. So those are the general, and you know, while we get into some of the particulars, one of the things that all of those things say to me is that it, in many ways, it renders the notion of black nationalism as like this immature, less civilized political perspective, and that these criticisms serve as ways to move beyond, which to me feels very anti-black, right? It seems to me that the mere idea of black people controlling the institutions that govern our lives, the idea that inherently means that black folks are interested in engaging in capitalism. It's like black folks are more sophisticated than that. Our history, the history of black nationalist formations are more communal and socialistic and the like. But yeah, I mean, to me, it just seems that these things point to this notion of Black nationalism being inherently less mature, which to me, what it does is that it almost in many ways signifies this notion of inherent Black inferiority that I don't think is applied to other forms of ethnic nationalism of folks of color. I don't see it attributed to that.